Good afternoon. Board. Priority. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Do you hear me well? Yes. My name is Ziad Abdelnour. I'm president of the U.S. Committee for Free Lebanon and a member of the New York Board of Governors of the Middle East Forum. Thank you for coming today to another exciting Middle East briefing. Today's event features Dr. Eyaz Visser talking about Hezbollah's missile threat on Israeli civilian areas. Please, if you could turn off your cell phones and pagers and phone questions and comments until the end of the program when Daniel Pipes will conduct a question and answer session. About our speaker, Eyal Visser, I hope I pronounced it right, Eyal, a senior research fellow at the Moshe Dayan Center of Tel Aviv University, brought the startling implications of this weapons hoard to light in a recent Middle East Quarterly article, where he showed that after 2.5 years of relative calm in South Lebanon, Hezbollah has become both more committed to and more capable of pursuing Israel's destruction than ever before. In his talk, Mr. Visser will explain Hezbollah's substantial power and how its unilateral actions could unsettle the whole Middle East region. Since earning his PhD from Tel Aviv University in 1992, Eyal Visser has emerged as one of the foremost authorities on Lebanon and Syria. The author of two books, Lebanon, the Challenge of Independence, and Assad's Legacy, Syria in Transition, he has written widely in the press on these subjects. It is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Eyal Visser.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon to all of you. Thank you for inviting me here. I just arrived from Washington, where I took part in the NASA annual conference. This is the conference of the American scholars that deal with the Middle East. And I don't need to tell you what they do think about the Middle East and about the American policy in the Middle East. And surprisingly enough, this year Israel was not attacked. It was very easy for Israeli scholars to take part in this conference. They found a new enemy, George Bush, and policy in the region. But so this is why I'm so pleased to come to this gathering that welcoming me so friendly and warmly. Well, Hezbollah, I think it was a year and a half ago when Hassan Nasrallah, Secretary General of Hezbollah, took part in a ceremony to observe 1 year after the death of Hafez al-Assad. And he gave there a speech. I read this speech. First I read the text of this speech. I couldn't believe what I had read, and I went to see it, or to watch it on TV, and indeed the text was accurate. And what Nasrallah had to say in this occasion, he spoke highly about Hafez al-Assad, what a great leader he was, what a great loss his death was for the Arabs. And then he said that unfortunately he had never had the opportunity to meet Hafez al-Assad face to face. Now think about it. Later I checked and maybe he met Hafez al-Assad once. But all of you who follow very closely events in Syria and Lebanon know that Hafez al-Assad used to meet very often with all the Lebanese notables. You could be the least important member in the parliament, and Hafez al-Assad would find time to meet you, to have a chat with you for hours. Nasrallah, he never met. And I thought to myself, well, why should he meet with Hassan Nasrallah? Who is Hassan Nasrallah? After all, Assad is the president of Syria, he is the effective ruler of Lebanon. Nasrallah is a worker who is working for the Syrians. And if Hafez al-Assad needs something, he can send, you know, one of his officers in Lebanon to give the necessary, needed instruction to Nasrallah. Why should he meet him face to face? This is to tell you about the balance of power and about the relations that were at that time between Hezbollah, which was a tool in the hands of the Syrian, and Hafez al-Assad. But of course, after the death of Hafez al-Assad, this is a different story. And indeed, in that ceremony, Nasrallah went on and spoke very warmly about the young and the promising new president of Syria, who will enjoy, he promised the audience, the full support of the Hezbollah. We will back him. He is promising, he is a young, promising leader. And indeed, I think that Nasrallah meets very often Bashar al-Assad. And when Bashar became president of Syria, many of us thought, and I think it was King Abdullah of Jordan who said that after all, Bashar is my age, but Bashar belongs to my generation, the generation of the internet. But speaking about models, speaking about young emerging leaders, well, it's not Abdullah or other Arab rulers that became friends of Bashar al-Assad or models for Bashar al-Assad, but Hassan Nasrallah. And this is an important factor, because what Bashar represents is the emerging young Arab generation that is now taking power in Moscow, in many of the Arab countries. Some of them became the leaders. In other cases, we are speaking about an emerging elite that take control over the economy. And speaking about this young generation that is unexperienced, and more important, it's not that he forgot the lesson of the past. He never had the opportunity to draw any conclusions or any lessons from any past experience. While with the case of Hafez al-Assad and Hosni Mubarak, we are speaking about, in the case of Mubarak, an old leader, very experienced leader, who experienced a war with Israel and knows what a war with Israel means. Well, with Bashar al-Assad and the emerging young Arab generation, the war with Israel, what they have in mind is not the Six-Day War, not even the October War, but the Intifada. And mainly what took place in southern Lebanon during the 80s and the 90s. This is to say, Hezbollah comes, killed 2-3 Israeli soldiers, and Israel immediately escaped. Israel immediately gave up. And speaking about the threat Hezbollah is posing to the stability of this region of the Middle East, the first threat, an important threat, is of course the psychological threat. Hezbollah is a symbol. Think about the 90s, the good old days, when we were all sure that peace is a matter of time. And when we looked at the Arab street, when we looked at the Arab world, well, the message was very clear. The majority of the Arabs do understand the need for peace, do understand that in order to get something from Israel, the only way to do it is through negotiations, by signing peace agreements. This was the clear message. There was a general consensus. That's what we thought at that time. That only through negotiation you can get something from Israel, and the negotiation and the peace process is the only game in town. And on the sideline, very much to the sideline of the Arab world, there were a small minority, Hezbollah, who argued the opposite. I mean, you are not going to get anything through the peace negotiations. If you want to get something from Israel, it's only by using force. And if it doesn't work, use more force. And that's what they did. And think about it, 10 years later, it seems even today to many Arabs that they were proven right. Look at what happened in the Israeli-Palestinian and the Israeli-Syrian flat after 10 years of peace negotiations. It didn't lead anywhere. It didn't give the Arabs anything. Look at what the Hezbollah did in Lebanon, in their eyes. They defeated Israel for the first time. They defeated the Israeli army. For the first time, Israel was forced to withdraw from an Arab territory occupied by it without getting anything in return. No peace agreement, no ceasefire agreement, not even quite understanding, not even understanding that well, will enjoy quiet and calm along your border. The opposite happened. I mean, Hezbollah and the Syrians send a very clear message: you're not going to enjoy any quiet time. And Hezbollah turned to be a model. And when we look at what happened in the Palestinian territories, the link is very clear. Think about it. Along the long history of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, we never witnessed this phenomenon of suicide bombers. You know from where it came. It came from Iran, where we saw these, the key children, those who were given keys and were sent to the field mines during the Iran-Iraq war, with keys that will open them the gates to paradise when they are being killed. And then this phenomenon, we saw it in Lebanon. The first targets were the American Marines in Lebanon in 1983. And then we saw it against Israel in southern Lebanon. And eventually it got to the territories. In 1993, Prime Minister Rabin deported hundreds of Hamas activists to southern Lebanon as a punishment. They were sent there, they were allowed to return a year later, but in the meantime they were trained by the Hezbollah and by the Iranians, and when they came back they brought with them this philosophy and these tactics. Now there is a clear link between the eruption of the Intifada and what happened in southern Lebanon. It was said very clearly by the Palestinians. The Hezbollah taught us an important lesson. And my point is that as long as the Hezbollah is active, is present in the arena, it will continue to be a model for an alternative to the peace, a successful alternative in the eyes of many in the Arab world, to the peace negotiation, to the peace process. And indeed, one of the problems we are having with the Hezbollah is that they really believe that they defeated the Israeli army. Now we can argue about it, whether it was a defeat, whether it was a victory. What is important is that in the eyes of the Hezbollah, in the eyes of many in the Arab, in the Muslim world, the Hezbollah did it. For the first time, they defeated the Israeli army, proving to the entire Arab world how weak Israel is. And I just heard an analysis by an Israeli Arab, Azmi Bshara, who is known for his pan-Arab views, that tried to explain the audience why Hezbollah did it and the Palestinian failed in their efforts to defeat Israel. Why, after 30 Israeli soldiers dead in southern Lebanon, this was the annual price or cost of the Israel presence in southern Lebanon, Israel was forced to leave.
while in the case of the Palestinian territories, we speak of almost 1,000 casualties, and still Israel is standing. And what he had to say was very interesting. He said that in Lebanon there was one address. The Hezbollah took control over the guerrilla fighting, the resistance, or the struggle against Israel. It got to the point where when Palestinian activists tried to launch separate and independent attacks against Israel, they were arrested by the Hezbollah. The Hezbollah sent a very strong message: we are the only one who side with Israel in this arena, and everything is under our control. There was one address, unlike the Palestinian, when you have the Hamas, and when Arafat wants a ceasefire, Hamas is not interested in a ceasefire, but Hamas and Arafat are interested in a ceasefire, the jihad. Islamic Jihad is not interested in Lebanon. There was one address. The second point was that the activities, the operations of the Hezbollah were proven to be more effective. Now, in what way more effective? After all, when you look back at the struggle they conducted against Israel, well, the operation, the result was in one case two Israeli soldiers dead, in another case five Israeli soldiers. Okay, it's not like the suicide bombers and the suicide bomb that killed 30 Israelis in the Bethlehem massacre. And still, the point he made was that it was effective because Israel limited scale activities aimed at Israeli soldiers and not activities and operations that were aimed at Israeli civilians that caused such a drastic retaliation from the side of Israel, or pushed Israel to the side. Unlike the case of the Palestinian, the tactic of the Hezbollah was to hit, to attack, to kill every now and then, every week, every 2 weeks, an Israeli soldier, two Israeli soldiers, and the cumulative effect was that Israel was forced to withdraw from southern Lebanon. These tactics didn't give Israel the excuse to retaliate the way it retaliated against the Palestinians. But let's move now to the other dimension of the threat Hezbollah is posing to Israel, and this is of course the military capabilities that it built, it acquired for itself during the years. Now there is always this argument that Hezbollah is undergoing a clear process of Lebanonization, and that it becomes a pure Lebanese section like the other sections in Lebanon, and that we shouldn't do too much, or we shouldn't make too much out of its military might and military capabilities, and eventually we should be patient, we shouldn't retaliate. I mean, eventually this will end in Hezbollah becoming a pure and total political party with no any military dimension to its activity. My argument is that this is not the case. Now, it's true that Hezbollah has many faces. It's a social organization, it's a political organization, it has an educational system, health system, it has worker union under its control. It has many faces, but it has also a military, clear military dimension. And in my eye, it is something that the Hezbollah will never give up as long as it is in their hands. Because when you speak about the need to fight against Israel, when you speak about the need to have a militia in a country like Lebanon, this is something understandable. Each of the communities, if you look at the Druze or, well, other
communities, each has, even sometimes families, has a militia. You want to fight Israel, it's important to gain some points in the public debate. Okay, so you buy for yourself some guns. What is the logic to acquire almost 10,000 advanced missiles that can force almost 1.5 million Israelis to enter into shelters in less than half an hour, that can be activated in a matter of minutes? Now it's quite clear to me what happened there. This was Iran that was behind the providing Hezbollah this capability. What the Iranian had in mind was to prevent Israel from attacking Iran the way they attacked Iraq in 81, attacking the nuclear reactor of Iraq in 81 in Iraq. When Israel attacked Iraq in 81, Saddam Hussein had no answer to this Israeli attack. Eventually he argued that the missile attack against Israel in 91 during Gulf War was some kind of retaliation, late retaliation, but a retaliation to the Israeli attack. But at that time in 81, he didn't have any answer to this Israeli attack. He couldn't prevent it from happening, and when it happened he couldn't retaliate in no way. This is something the Iranian had in mind, especially when Israel is paying, as you all know, attention to the Iranian efforts to acquire nuclear weapons, and especially when Israel is considering Iran as one of its worst enemy or dangerous enemy in this region. And the Iranian logic was very simple. We should build Iranian capabilities in southern Lebanon or in Lebanon that will create a balance of terror between us and Israel, a balance of terror that will prevent Israel from even thinking about attacking Iran, because these missiles that Iran provided to Hezbollah will be used against Israel the moment Israel is attacking Iran. This was the logic behind, because there is no other logic. I mean, if you want to have a militia, it's okay. If you want to help this militia, it's okay. So you give it some money, so you provide it with some guns and some weapons, but we are speaking about almost 10,000 advanced missiles, something that most of the Arab countries, I mean, it's far more than Jordan has. Jordan has no such missiles. Syria has some limited, a few dozen missiles, long away deployed, far away from the Israeli border. Egypt is far away. The only entity that has such capabilities is the Hezbollah. And actually, because of this Iranian logic, Hezbollah became an important or a crucial element. Now, on the one hand, the Iranians provided Hezbollah with this weapon. But on the other hand, when Iranian has some control over Hezbollah, Syrian had used to have some control over the Hezbollah. I don't think that this is the case anymore, and I show it quite clearly when I mentioned that Hafez al-Assad didn't bother to meet Nasrallah. Nowadays, Bashar considers Nasrallah as a model that should be followed. And actually, the decision is in the hand of the Hezbollah, whether to use these missiles or not. And this is the problem, because we are speaking here about a militia, not a country, not a state. I mean, you can say whatever you want about Syria, but this is a state and has a constraint. This is not the case with the Hezbollah. We are speaking here about a militia that is sure that he defeated Israel, that is sure that it has the key or the solution, or it knows the way how to defeat Israel, and there's these enormous
capabilities. This is a very dangerous situation. It is dangerous to the stability of Lebanon, and let me remind you that the aim of Hezbollah is not necessarily to occupy or to liberate Jerusalem. There is one station in this in the way, and this is to turn, and they said it very clearly, Lebanon into an Islamic Republic. It's still on their agenda. It's a danger to the stability of Lebanon and to the existence of Lebanon as a pluralist society. Although Bashar al-Assad doesn't understand that it's a danger, but it's dangerous to Syria as well, and of course it's dangerous to Israel. Now, we are speaking here about smart guys. They will not give Israel so easily the excuse to retaliate. They are not the Palestinians. They have full control over the known people. But they are playing with fire. It's quite clear that whenever they see a window of opportunities, they will use it. Take, for example, defensive shield. They came to the conclusion that this is the right time to beat Israel, and there was an escalation. Till they decide, not necessarily Syria, not even Iran, till they decide that this window of opportunities was shut down. Whenever, it's not a matter of retaliation, it's not a matter of responding to an Israeli attack. Whenever they see an opportunity, they will use it. And by doing so, they are playing with fire. Now, what they have in mind is not to open a new front along the Israeli-Lebanese front, the border. I don't think that that's what they want. Their tactic is totally different. They want to hit Israel. They believe not in a conventional total war, but in a guerrilla war that will eventually bring Israel to give up. That's what happened in the past. That's what they hope that might happen nowadays. But they are playing with fire. And whenever you play with fire, hoping that you will be able to control the level of the fire, well, sometimes it gets out of control. And let me conclude my opening remark by arguing that today they are facing, and I think they came to realize it, a different Israel. It's not anymore Israel that they faced in the 90s. It's not anymore Israel under Barak that was ready to withdraw from Lebanon. It's a different Israel. Israel that is eager. And I'm speaking now about on the political establishment, the government, but mainly on the military establishment. Israel that is eager to retaliate, to take revenge, to teach them a lesson. If you listen very carefully to what former Chief of Staff Shaul Mofaz had to say about his achievements as Chief of Staff, the main point he made was, I showed Nasrallah that Israel can withstand, that it cannot be defeated the way he thought he can, or the Palestinians can or should do following the Israeli withdrawal. And if you listen to what the current Israeli Chief of Staff had to say, I mean, his main mission is to show Nasrallah that he is now facing a different Israel. I don't know if Israel really has the answers to the challenges or to the threats it is faced, the threat posed by the Hezbollah, but it's a different Israel, it's a different it's a different story. And when there is an eagerness and readiness on the Israeli side to retaliate, not to let the Hezbollah go on playing, and when you have the Hezbollah playing with fire, well, one should we should
it's very hard to predict, of course, but there is a potential for escalation and explosion along the Israeli-Lebanese border in the coming months. I'll conclude now. And
thank you so much, Al-Jazeera. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's great to be out of this briefing. This is my first one of the fall. Been traveling. I thank Gary Gamble for taking my place in all the preceding events. I thank the officer for joining us after his visit to Mesa. As you may know, we are engaged in a bit of a tussle with Mesa these days. We thought it would be a good idea to invite you all to speak about this topic because there's some press by his article in the Middle East Quarterly along these lines. And I'd like to start the questioning by asking a couple points. First, you alluded at the end to, Israel having changed. This is no longer the Israel of Iraq, but Israel of the 1990s, Israel of the Oslo process, Israel that accommodates and backs down. Would you agree with the notion that, let me say it as a premise, that Israel had a policy of deterrence from its existence in 1948 until about 1993, and then it went into a different mode for 7 years, and now it's returned to that policy of deterrence. And it doesn't seem to me that Hezbollah has figured that out. The Palestinians haven't figured that out. You say that Hezbollah is smarter than the Palestinians, but the evidence you're giving us suggests that they're not really smart. But they still think this is the 1990s, and that they'll come to make a terrible, terrible misjudgment as a result. Are you confident that they really are figuring out that there are new chiefs of staff, new politicians, that are more fundamentally a new spirit in Israel? And secondly, what are, in your estimation, the ultimate goals of Hezbollah? One, an Islamic Republic in Lebanon. Two, an Islamic Republic of Palestine. What is it? Where does the liberation of Jerusalem come in? Is it more important? Is it a side issue? Is it as important? What is this organization ultimately about?
Okay.
Thank
you judging from the past experience, we can see how careful the Hezbollah are. I think that during the last 3 months there was no any attack. There was no, the last 3 or 4 months there was no any attack by the Hezbollah. They are more aware to their limits nowadays because of the 9/11 events, because of the coming American attack against Iraq, and because they do understand that they might face an Israeli retaliation. Now, let's have a look. Following the Israeli withdrawal, there was a period of relative quiet, and then when the Intifada erupted, they started their attacks against Israel. Well, actually, every two or three weeks. It stopped when every 2 or 3 weeks there was an attack by Hezbollah, killing an Israeli soldier here, an Israeli soldier there. It stopped when Sharon came to power and started this policy of retaliation. During 2001, he attacked Israeli, the IDF attacked twice Syrian positions in Lebanon as some kind of retaliation. Now, then failed the escalation during the offensive Shind, but whenever they came to the conclusion that although Israel is engaged in war against the Palestinians, it might retaliate in parts of Lebanon as well, this escalation came to an end. And let me remind you that actually the Israeli government took a decision. I mean, there was a vote in the government on some kind of retaliation against Syrian position in Lebanon, against Syrian targets, and against the Hezbollah. got the approval of the government, it was in April 2002, but then Sharon argued that since it was not a vast majority, and since he is not sure that there is a wide consensus in Israel in support for retaliation, he preferred to wait. And my point is that we see how careful the Hezbollah became. I mean, of course, they are trying to test Israel all the time. They are trying to use any windows of opportunity that are open to them. But they are very careful not to let or to give Israel an excuse, because they know what might be the Israeli retaliation. I think that unlike the Palestinians, they do understand that well. They are now facing a different Israeli government. My argument is that while speaking about their vision, they vision an Islamic Republic from Tehran to the sea, they are focused on Lebanon. It's quite clear. Nasrallah is encouraging the Palestinians. He is ready that the Palestinians will fight till the last Palestinian. But I don't see him too supportive and too active and too engaged in the Palestinian intifada. It's true that the Hezbollah is trying to establish links to the Israeli Arabs and to operate some Israeli Arabs. It's true that it had some cells among Palestinians. It's true that it was involved in the Karin A issue. They were those who negotiated, mediated between the Iranians and the Palestinian authority. It's clearly that to me that it's clear to me that they are trying to teach the Palestinians or to convince the Palestinians to follow them. It was very interesting to listen to Nasrallah suggesting that the Hezbollah, that the Palestinians should stop attack Israeli civilians and instead focus on or aiming at Israeli soldiers instead of Israeli civilians. I think that the military dimension is important for him. I think that whenever there is an opportunity, he will use it. But still, liberating Palestine, I don't think that right now this is his main goal. He is more focused on Lebanon, establishing himself in Lebanon. That's what is up to. The problem is that something will follow eventually, and the problem is also that he is not ready to give up the military dimension of its activity. The problem that he is playing this far, the problem that he was given, it's like a child that was given a gift that is far beyond his capabilities. That's the problem. I'm not sure that he was fully aware, that the Syrian was fully aware to the gift that Hezbollah got from the Iranians. This is, I think, the problem with Hezbollah.
Dr. Zisser, given that Hezbollah is becoming an increasing threat to Israel, given that Hezbollah is holding Lebanese economy hostage, you know, to their own will, so they are becoming also an increasing threat to Lebanon's very existence. Given that Hezbollah is serving as a role model for other Arab Islamic fundamentalist terrorists, etc. Given that we are at the dawn of a war with Iraq, and given your inner knowledge of the workings of Syria and Hezbollah, what would you specifically do if you were Prime Minister of Israel today, and if you were President of the United States?
Well, I had the opportunity to speak with some American officials, both in the National Security Council and the State Department, about this issue. And I asked them, what are you going to do about the activity in Hezbollah and the backing of the Syrians to this activity? And the answer was, we'll express our concern to the Syrians.
Excuse me, the question is that, what would you...
Yeah. And then I asked them, and if the Syrian will not respond, they said, we'll repeat and express our concern for the Syrians. Then they asked me, what do you think will be the Syrian reading of this concern? And I told them, the Syrian will understand it as a green light, do whatever you want, we'll express our concern, but you can do whatever. This is the problem Israel is facing. Without an American backing, Israel can do only little. I think that the Americans undermine the card they have. When you look how assertive the American policy is towards Iraq, to me it's very difficult to understand why the Americans do not do anything regarding towards Syria. Actually letting the Syrian playing the Syrian well-known game. I think America can, the United States can and should make much more pressure on Syria. Syria is not interested in, I mean, of course the Syrians use the Hezbollah for their purposes. They do not admire the Hezbollah. They know that in the long run Hezbollah is actually or can become an enemy to the I mean, Syria is interested in a prosperous Lebanese economy because it's under its control, of course, but Syria is not interested in the Iranian influence, increasing Iranian influence in this region. So it can be brought to take effective measures against the Hezbollah in a certain point, but only if it's pushed by the United States to the corner. This doesn't happen, but maybe it will happen in the future. It didn't happen in the past, it's not happening today, and without an American backing, Israel can do only a little, unless Israel is pushed to the corner. In the case of the Palestinians, Israel felt that it was pushed to the corner. There was an Israeli consensus, a very general wide consensus, and then you can defensive shield in the following operations. If there will be a major attack by Hezbollah, Israel retaliates, and there will be a massive support for such a retaliation, and Israel can deal more successfully, less successfully, but can deal with the threat of Hezbollah. But only if there is, if Hezbollah gives an excuse, or only if there is an American backing. I don't see it happening in the coming months, but, well, we'll have to wait and see.
Can I stretch that point that you just made a little bit further? What if, say, 6 months down the line, you're called and you're sitting there with perhaps representatives of both Israel and the United States saying that Hezbollah is a strong threat? What would you recommend? What would you then say?
Well, Hezbollah gets its money and its supply from Iran through Damascus. Cut this link, cut this pipe very easy. Without the Iranian backing, Hezbollah is, I mean, shouldn't undermine the Hezbollah is well established among the Shiites in Lebanon. It enjoys, I don't know, massive support, but it enjoys the support of some, at least, I don't know, 20-30% of the Shiites. I don't know the figures, but still, as far as the military dimension is concerned, without an Iranian backing, they cannot do much. If you make pressure on Syria, and if Syria is pushed to the corner, and if Syria stops supporting the Hezbollah, and if Syria doesn't allow the Iranians to support the Hezbollah, this is at least the first step towards eliminating, but reducing the threat that Hezbollah is putting to the entire region.
Thank you.
and it can be done. It's not a big, you don't need to start a war for that. Only to phone President Bashar al-Assad to call him and to tell him that it's easy.
Could you tell us the effect of the recent Labour Party elections and the statements made by General Mislim on Hezbollah or any other Arab parties?
Well, there is ongoing debate in Israel whether what Barak did in 2000 was right or wrong, whether the pull out from Lebanon was a clever thing to do. I mean, because Barak is still convinced that it was a brilliant move, and that actually the situation of today is better than the situation that Israel was facing a year or 2 years ago. Now, we had a point. I mean, let's face it. On the one hand, the pullout sent a very dangerous, negative message. We are weak. We are. On the other hand, before the pullout, Israel was engaged in constant battle. Almost 30 Israeli soldiers were killed each year, and the number of the operations carried out by the Hezbollah, well, here we speak about one operation every 3 months. At that time, these were hundreds of operations each month. So, I mean, he can argue that nowadays the situation, in a way, is better. But, of course, this debate has to do with the debate that is now going on in Israel, whether Israel should, repeat this move also in the Gaza and in the West Bank. Surprisingly enough, the Palestinians are not totally happy about such a move. I mean, there are people in Israel that argue that it will encourage the Palestinians to continue the struggle. It will persuade the Palestinians that actually only by using force on Israel you can. But I think that as far as the West Bank and Gaza are concerned, this is more problematic. The demographical dimension should be mentioned. The fact that, unlike Lebanon, there are Israeli settlers and settlements in these territories. And what the Palestinians are afraid is that the episode of 48 will repeat itself. 48, what I mean is that actually in 48, Israel decides by itself what should be the border. Now we know that the borders of 48 were different than the borders of 47. They were better to Israel. Nobody in the world at that time accepted it. Eventually, everybody came to agree that this should be the border. Now the Palestinians are scared that Israel will history will repeat itself. I mean, Israel will draw to a line. It's not going to be the 67, it's going to be a different line. And eventually, this will be the new line. 10 years, 15 years, this will be, and they could get 97 or 99% of the territories from Barak. In 5 years, they can will be able to get only 70% or something like that. So, the debate is going on in Israel. Since the Hezbollah is following very closely the political debate in Israel and political developments in Israel, they understand, they know that Mitzna is an episode. I mean, maybe in the future, episode. I mean, nobody thinks seriously that in the coming election he might win. So, but maybe it will have, maybe in 3, 4, 5 years, it's a cycle after all. You will come back to that point where you have been in 99, in the same perception and the same consensus?
Just a comment. One of the interesting things that I'm hearing is that one wants to have an intelligent enemy. I mean, one would rather have a Hafez al-Assad than a Saddam Hussein. One would rather have a Hezbollah than a Yasser Arafat. There's a rationality there. You can build, you can plan, you can project. When you have a stupid enemy, you don't know what to expect, right?
Yeah.
More questions?
How large is the military range of the Hezbollah? And the extent of the Iraq war, what are the positions that Hezbollah might take?
Well, first of all, the military wing, we speak here about less than 1,000 people, few hundred. Now think about it, few hundred at that time, you know, in the 90s, defeated, so-called, an army of almost 250,000 soldiers. There were almost 10,000 Israeli soldiers in the security zone in southern Lebanon, and they were, okay, so-called defeated by few hundred activists of Hezbollah. Yeah, 200 activists of Hezbollah. Now the military wing, they have more missiles, much more missiles than activists or soldiers. This is the first point, but of course to launch missiles, and you don't need more than, you know, it's not an army, they're not fighting like an army. To launch missiles, you don't need, you know, full army. It's enough. One man, it's a very simple weapon, and all what you need is one man, and you can launch 10, 20 rockets in 5-10 minutes. That's the story. Now, as far as the coming war with Iraq, on the one hand, we have to remember that if there is an opportunity, we should expect the Hezbollah to attack Israel. On the other hand, it's not that they hate Saddam more than they hate Israel, but they are not good friends of Saddam. They are not interested in his victory. On the contrary, they are supported by Iran, and we can see that actually Iran is not against the coming war. It has concerns about what might happen in Iraq, but it is much more supportive maybe than Mubarak, or of course they can't say it, but actually they say it, right? But so Hezbollah has no interest in, you know, interfering with an American attack against Iraq. They know that they are on the American list. And as I said before, they are smart. They will not let the Americans an excuse to attack them after the war. I mean, Nasrallah had the point that America might collapse in, you know, 5-6 years. He said it in an interview that nobody believed that Soviet Union would collapse. And it happened. So, I think it was after the Enron. He said, look at what is going on with the American economy and the American political system. They will collapse. So we should wait. So shouldn't be afraid of the Americans. We got some suggestions from them, but it's a right. Turn to be a political party and we'll be your friends. But why should I accept it? I mean, that's what he said. But he knows that he's on the American list. After all, he killed more Americans than Israelis. And he will be very careful not to give the Americans any excuse.
What about turning it around and asking, could Israel take advantage of an Iraq war to do its business vis-a-vis Hezbollah?
The problem is that any confrontation with Hezbollah means that 1 million and a half Israelis will have to stay for weeks, days in shelters. That there will be, I don't know how many, but there will be casualties. This is something that you, civilian casualties, this is something that you can't do unless you are pushed to the corner, as far as the Israeli dynamics, political dynamics are. so maybe Israel is waiting, but it will let the Hezbollah to make the mistake.
What do you see as the reason Assad sees an advantage in the creation of this foreign letting of arms and his advantage to see a people?
Well, under Hafez al-Assad, I think first of all that the Syrians preferred to ignore what was happening there, and they were surprised as well to see what emerged there, because it's not in their interest to have such a strong Hezbollah. But under Hafez al-Assad, well, as I mentioned before, Assad was a worker, hard worker. I mean, why should I bother with? After all, he's getting the instruction and he's doing exactly what I'm telling him to do. With Bashar, it's totally different. There were reports that Bashar himself started to supply Hezbollah with advanced missiles, Syrian missiles for the first time, that is integrating the Hezbollah into the military Syrian disposition in southern Lebanon or in Lebanon, that he starts to consider them as an element in its military capabilities and answers to Israel. There were numerous reports suggesting that actually some of the old guard surrounds Bashar warning of supporting the Hezbollah, warning of becoming the puppet in the hand of Nasrallah. And still, I think that he is young, unexperienced, very emotional sometimes, really believes that, well, Nasrallah found a way how to deal with Israel. But the fact that he was ready to support the American the decision of the Security Council does suggest that he knows his limits, and he, when pushed to the corner, he will be more careful than it seemed to be in the past. But the logic, his logic was that actually it's a tool in our hand against Israel. It will remind Israel that they should withdraw from the Golan Heights and achieve peace with us, and this is the only card we have. But as I mentioned before, there is a difference between having Hezbollah and militia that can play a limited role of killing one Israel, and then have what Hezbollah turned to be, you know, a political entity, a military entity, a military empire. I mean, it's something dreadful what is going on nowadays with Hezbollah in Lebanon.
Let me just ask you quickly. You mentioned the Syrian vote in the Security Council. That certainly came as a surprise to many people. Could you put it in context? Were you expecting something of that sort? Is it a change?
Well, the Syrians themselves, of course, they argued that it was a victory for the Syrian diplomacy, and they defeated the Americans, and they it actually to prevent the war. But the Syrian said it very clearly from the beginning: we are not Saddam Hussein. Syria is not so. Syria under the Assad dynasty is not Iraq under Saddam Hussein. We will never get to the same place where Saddam is heading, or where Saddam is. We are more rational, we are more realistic, we are more pragmatic. Now, there was the question with Bashar, whether he will follow the legacy of his father, because that's what his father did quite successfully. And on the one hand, it was a surprise, because at least as far as the Syrian rhetoric was concerned, I mean, they were very anti-Americans. But he followed the legacy of his father. That's quite clear.
I think what you see is that below the headlines in the Middle East, below the Palestinian-Israeli war, below the prospective war with Iraq, below Al-Qaeda and the North Islamic groups, there's a lot more going on in the region. It's seething. And I thank Dr. Zisser for following this, carefully elucidating it so intelligently, and coming here today and presenting for us his analysis and conclusions. This is our last meeting of 2002, unless something happens surprisingly in December. I'd like to thank you for your attendance and look forward to seeing you in the new year.
I think we covered all
the